This is Mark Strassman, reporter with Broadband Wireless Access World. We're about to talk to Greg Richardson, who's the president of Civitium, was involved as the director of the study for the Wireless Houston County Committee's study of broadband wireless access in that community. Welcome to Broadband Wireless Access World.
Thanks, Mark.
Why don't you talk a little bit about how you got involved in this study, whether you went to them, they came to you, and how you, Siemens, and the committee there in Houston County got to studying broadband wireless access for the community.
Sure. Well, Mark, I was formerly the national director, mobile director for Siemens Business Services here in the U.S., and Houston County had been working with Intel Corporation on some initiatives that dealt with the use of technology in education. Intel had deployed some technology in the high school system within Houston County, and had briefed the community on this new technology, wireless broadband, or WiMAX. And after that, the community formed a committee which included local elected officials, as well as some business and community leaders. Siemens was brought in March of 2004 to lead a consulting study for the committee, which was focused on a number of areas, really four areas. The first was that the committee wanted to assess the existing broadband infrastructure that was available in the county to determine if there was indeed demand that wasn't being met. The second was that the committee needed recommendations and wanted us to analyze what the appropriate role of local government should be. Should they burden the taxpayers? Should they compete with the private sector, et cetera? The third area that the study focused on was to identify a business model, a way in which local government could be involved in the value chain for providing universal broadband service. And the fourth area was to determine the economic and technical feasibility. Could wireless broadband or WiMAX technology address the demand that existed in the community?
Okay, say a little bit about Siemens Business Services as an organization. What kind of projects does it do?
Well, Siemens Business Services is a consulting and outsourcing company. It is, of course, a division of Siemens AG, the German company. Globally, Siemens Business Services is about a $6 billion organization and focused primarily on consulting and outsourcing services for both the private and public sector.
Okay, and as the National Mobility Practice Director, what were your responsibilities and areas of expertise?
Well, my responsibilities included I led a consulting practice that was focused on helping public and private sector organizations deal with and develop strategies, develop designs, deploy wireless technology, and then ultimately manage that technology. So my role specifically with the project was I was the lead consultant, and I also brought the other resources that were required to bear in the project.
Okay, was your own background more engineering or more economics?
Or more business? Yeah, my background as a consultant is fairly well split between business and technology, so it was a fairly good fit. And in fact, I think most of the consultants I had on my team had similar backgrounds, a pretty good knowledge of business, but also grounded in a certain area of technology, in my case, wireless.
Okay, so you're pretty well qualified then to work out what the questions are and what possible answers are as to how to deploy a new technology and how government should be involved and how business should be involved and how the private sector and how community should be involved.
Sure, and a lot of it is, as you said, asking the right questions and really getting the community that we interviewed about 50 people or so throughout the course of the project. A whole variety. We interviewed the incumbent telecommunications providers who operated in the region. We interviewed most of the elected officials, the mayors, the presidents of the Chamber of Commerce, city council members. We interviewed the leaders for the education system at the Board of Education, as well as the county commissioner's office. And through that process, really came to a lot of what we think the right answers were in the project.
Did you mainly ask them what they were doing and how they thought they could do it better if they had more internet connectivity?
Well, we certainly asked them about the impact that telecommunications had on their given area. So if we're talking to, for example, the Chamber of Commerce, a question that was asked was, what effect do you believe having universal access to broadband has on the businesses that are part of the Chamber?
Right.
And also, do you feel as though the price paid for those services is competitive and affordable in most cases?
Right. Who paid for the study? How much did it cost?
Well, we don't disclose the amount of the study, but what I can say is that it was roughly a 3-month consulting study, and it was it resulted in no fees that were paid by Houston County. It was co-sponsored by Intel and Siemens primarily, but we also leveraged investments that were made by Alvarian, the world's leading provider of wireless broadband solutions.
Okay, we're going to talk about them and their role in a minute. So essentially no taxpayers were harmed in the making of this study.
That's correct.
Okay. We're going to talk about Alvarian in the context of what you actually built. After you did the study, and we're going to talk a little bit about the results, but tell us what you decided to, well, let's go for the early part of the study. What did you find were the broadband access issues or availabilities as they varied from parts of the county to other parts?
Sure. Well, the county itself contains three incorporated cities that range in size from about 50,000 residents to about 5,000 residents, and it covers an area of about 400 square miles, sort of a fairly large size county, somewhat average in terms of counties in the south. What we found was that broadband, first of all, broadband service defined as anything above 256 kilobit per second. DSL and cable, of course, would qualify within that.
I don't want to be picky, but let's be a little picky.
Sure.
Doesn't the FCC say it's anything, it's essentially two-way, 200 kilobits per second, right?
Well, that actually was revised in the 2002 report that the FCC produced.
Okay.
To include services that were at or above 256 kilobits per second.
Okay, which is a more logical digital figure than 200 anyway.
Sure, so they basically define that ISDN service and below is not broadband.
Okay.
Services like DSL, even ADSL, the lower-end DSL offering, are broadband services.
Okay.
Of course, satellite qualifies as well.
Okay, so that's what we're talking about when we say broadband.
Yes, that's correct.
And again, what did you find the availability issues were?
Well, we found that if you look at the way communities are clustered in geographic areas, only about 20% of the land area within Houston County in this 400-square-mile area had availability to cable or DSL service.
Right.
However, again, because of densities of business and residential areas, that covered about 70% of the households and businesses within that community.
Right.
So we had about 30%, which tended to be much more sparsely populated, lower density areas.
So you're saying 70% of the population was in 20% of the land.
That's about right.
Right. In fact, what we've hit on here is a very crucial issue because whether it's slight differences in developmental opportunities in the rural parts of the counties versus the cities, or whether it's vast differences between rural parts of Africa or Asia or Latin America and the cities, there's a kind of vicious circle of there's no education or medical care or jobs in the rural parts of the country because there's no internet connectivity there.
That's absolutely correct. And in fact, there's marked a lot of precedent in this issue with the issue back in the 1920s and 30s, if you look at how power was brought to rural communities.
Right.
There was a very high capital cost to reach locations, but not enough aggregate demand within those locations, in many cases, to justify the capital cost.
That's what led to the TVA, among other causes.
That's correct. And the whole cooperative EMC model, if you will, in power, evolved as a result of that.
Right. And so, getting ahead of ourselves here, you're essentially saying that there are possibilities with broadband wireless to sort of jumpstart or solve that problem, aren't there?
Well, that's a key assumption that we made when the report and the study was commissioned, was that wireless broadband technology, a lot of people view it as, you hear terms like disruptive and game-changing and things like that, and that's usually applied to only one side of either technical or economic reasons. And the way we tried to view this in the study is that it's really techno-economic. It's really a combination of a new technology and the way in which that new technology can change the prior economics of a given business, in this case, telecommunications.
In fact, this is to oversimplify. This is finally found a way to keep them down on the farm, but allow them to have all of the comforts of city life.
That's absolutely correct.
Okay.
And actually, Mark, on that point, we actually used a great deal of prior research work as the report was. This issue, as you can imagine, has been studied in academic and even in corporate research areas for a number of years.
Right.
And that was extremely valuable for us in terms of being able to view the annual cost of supporting telecommunications infrastructure on a per-location basis in different what you might call demographics. In other words, if I compare the cost of DSL or cable in an area that has only 10 subscribers per 10 locations per square mile,
right.
That's a very different cost per location number than if I compared it in, let's say, a downtown NFL city.
Right, and in fact, it ends up becoming exorbitantly expensive, so that the possible those 10 possible users out there can't pay for it, and the companies can't make any money out of it, so it never happens.
Well, therein lies the problem, in that the private sector is motivated primarily, for obvious reasons, by shareholder gain,
right.
And they have to make business decisions that are profitable. In the case of elected officials, they represent the other end of the extreme. They
right.
represent the citizens, the economic social development of a region, and bringing those two together, the two motivations together, is really what we were trying to do with the study.
Okay, well, that segues nicely into the second point, which is your exploration of the appropriate role for government.
Sure.
What are sort of the options for government, and what did you find in your study that the local government officials and the people felt were the appropriate choices amongst those options?
Sure. Well, when we went through the interview process, particularly with the elected officials, we found that the local government there was it was a very conservative political environment, meaning
right.
that the majority of the elected officials were Republican. They had very much a view that the public sector did not need to be meddling in the private sector's business.
Right.
And that in most cases, if any service could be provided by the private sector, that it was generally better that it be done so.
Did they have any specific, were there any anecdotes or any specific comments about the fact that the private sector and free enterprise, as understood from a Republican perspective, wasn't delivering broadband to large swaths of the community?
Well, I can tell you one anecdote that we came across, and that was during the interview with one of the Chamber of Commerce. It's not a consolidated government, so each of the cities has their own Chamber of Commerce.
Right.
And we found that as new people and even new businesses were started, particularly in the southern half of the county,
the more rural part.
Yes, the more rural part of the county, which is more agricultural in nature, a lot of farms and obviously less densely populated.
Right.
Typically, what would happen is calls would be made to a variety of offices. The Chamber of Commerce is where a lot of those calls end up. And they basically complain about the issue of not having anything other than dial-up as an option for
right.
broadband service. And they would talk about the impact that has. So I think a lot of people would view that, for example, what does a farmer need with broadband? And the reality is there are farmers in the country and in certain communities that are surveying their crops with cameras. They have to check grain prices. I mean, there are a number of very valid business reasons why certain user usage groups, if you will, certain psychographics need broadband that you wouldn't necessarily think of off the top of your head.
Now, I don't know whether you were aware of it or whether they were under your radar, but I did an interview with someone in Georgia running the virtual Farm World, and they've got a research project going there in Georgia to use for the use of broadband in agriculture in Georgia and elsewhere. Are you familiar with that at all?
I came across that in some of the research I did, although it didn't find its way into the report. I think that's a great example of how some of these demographics and psychographics need services that, number one, very difficult to deliver to them, and number two, the private sector doesn't necessarily think of it off the top of their head.
Right. I mean, at the extreme, they were essentially talking about outsourcing farm management and running farms by computers and sending information in and taking it out by broadband and having vast farms run essentially by themselves with electronic support.
Sure.
And you could do that if you had this, of course, it's another question about what that does to the demographics, of course. But
mm-hmm.
So what did you ended up finding out was the sort of the resolution of the government business conundrum that seems to be underlying some of these problems?
Well, I guess to net out, what we found in terms of the local government was that there was a preference for a private sector model, as I said, and there was a preference. In fact, there was a tax cap in the county and almost a mandate that taxpayer dollars would not be used to build a service like this.
Right.
And what we ended up recommending were really two options that the government could take. The first option was they could continue on the path they were on, which was to have local government simply act as a catalyst and an enabler for the private sector.
Well, more specifically, what does being a catalyst and enabler mean they'd
sure.
be doing?
Well, it's two different things. Referring to them being a catalyst means that they continue to engage very actively in discussions with the private sector. That would include the incumbent providers. It might include private investors who would be interested in a service like that. And really promoting the fact that there is demand within the community.
Essentially urging them by saying, it would be good for us, it would be good for us, it would be good for you, why don't you do it?
That's correct. In other words, supply-side economics, if you will. You know, if we make the infrastructure, it supports economic development, and that economic development leads to more earnings for your company and more, you know, growth in taxpayer revenue for ours. So
right. And since I'm almost running out of rural images here, it's a kind of if you build it, they will come and pay for it. Sir.
That's correct. And there's a lot of precedent there in some of the communities we studied. If you look at Research Triangle Park in North Carolina,
right.
If you look at Austin, Texas, which is developed as a real technology corridor. Certainly, the long-standing Bay Area, the dynamics there. A lot of those communities started. It's not the only factor that influenced their ability to grow a high-tech economy and a rapid-growing economy, but advanced telecommunications was certainly one factor that contributed to it.
Well, advanced transportation and communications technologies have when the canals were the height of technological development. The Upstate New York was made possible by that, and so on.
That's right. And actually, I think that's a great example because you can draw a line, you can draw a comparison between the building of interstate systems,
right.
The building of transcontinental railroads. That was really about moving people, and the situation that we live in today is moving people. That's an issue that has largely been solved for the most part.
Right.
Now it's really about moving information . You know, I have compared sometimes where we are with the Internet today to being kind of where we are after the Transcontinental Railroad was built.
Right.
We have great points of presence if you can manage to get to a train station. The problem is that, that last mile, in our case, in the transportation world, really required a car and a bus system and some other things that telecommunications just haven't caught up to yet.
And in fact, for example, I think it was the original, if not the original, one of the early versions of the Whole Earth Catalog had a quote from Kenneth Patchen that said, "The flow of information through a system is what organizes the system," which means if you've got the ability to send this information into rural areas and into every place in a city, then that's where the structuring is going to take place because it's an information society, and access to the information is access to the society's benefits.
Right. Well, and the other side of the recommendation that we made, Mark, was that the government could act as an enabler. And what we meant by that, and we spelled out in the report, was that the government has many things that they control that could ease the investment burden of the private sector. So, for example, the county officials who write zoning ordinances to allow companies to put up cell towers or grant right-of-ways for telephone poles and, other, maybe they have different types of county-owned assets that could be used in this case for deploying base station equipment and things of that nature. So that part of it, both in terms of being a catalyst and promoting the supply side and also acting as an enabler and easing the investment burden, that was part of one recommendation, which is something that the government could do. The second recommendation that we made, which was really a second option, was that the government could choose to deploy, finance, own, operate, deploy, and manage this network on their own. Now, that goes against what I talked about earlier in terms of them not being interested in burdening the taxpayer. So what we did was we built an economic model that was based on the local government actually making this project cost neutral. So there would be a capital cost required up front to deploy the network, but our estimates with the government, the local government and quasi-government offices being what we call anchor tenants of that network, they could reduce their private sector telecommunications costs and essentially break even within about 12 to 14 months.
Does voice over IP come into play here?
Well, with the technology where it is today, we were evaluating pre-WiMAX or proprietary solutions from Alvarian. We didn't feel as though the technology was ready to be too aggressive for a number of reasons, to be too aggressive in terms of positioning it for voice services.
Okay.
We really were positioning this first and foremost. It is our view that that WiMAX will evolve to support voice services, but a number of technical advances have to be made first.
And in fact, it doesn't need it for the economic model to work.
That's right. The government wasn't using voice over IP in really any case to support their wireline or weren't using voice over IP over their wireline network, so there wasn't really a requirement that if they replaced that access with wireless broadband, that it support voice over IP.
Okay, repeat again what this, that's redundant, repeat please the 12 to 14 month scenario and what the government would do and what private industry would do and who would have to bear the cost or make the or get the benefits?
Well, in this model, we refer to the model as cooperative wholesale. And basically in this model, the government would fund, and we estimated the first year cost to deploy a countywide network to be about $700,000.
Okay.
So the government would take out of their budget about $700,000. They would build a network which would be government-owned. They would use that network to support what we refer to as anchor tenants, which are schools, libraries, city hall, county annex, you know, any type of government or in some cases even nonprofit organization in the county. But the wholesale part of the model was to respond to the issue about not competing with the private sector. What we recommended was that the government not engage in selling and marketing the service to retail subscribers. So that means if there's a business in Houston County who wants a T1 line and they want to replace it with this network, they would have to buy that from someone who was operating as what you might consider a retail wireless ISP. And that would promote additional competition within the county because wireless ISPs would essentially be able to sell and market a service and support subscribers without incurring all of the capital costs, which had been borne by the local government.
Oh, you're saying then that the local government bears the capital costs, and then in order to essentially get back most of its money, it uses these anchor tenants, schools, and especially itself, the local government agencies themselves, and sells it directly to itself in that sense.
Right.
And then the extra capacity that's not being used by the government and nonprofit sector is going to be retailed out to businesses and residences eventually by private companies that are already providing internet access or new ones that are going to set up to do this.
That's correct. And here's one of the challenges we faced in the project that relates to this, Mark, was that the incumbent telecommunications providers in the region objected to that, even to that model.
Right.
Basically saying that it was still taxpayer dollars being used to compete with them in the sense that the anchor tenants would be taken away from them. So if ABC Telecom was selling a T1 to government today, that contract would end and would go away.
Yeah, but
Their response to that, and we made this case, I think, fairly well, the response to that was that local governments make decisions every day about what they insource and what they outsource.
Right.
And I asked a question in a committee meeting. It's a useful anecdote. I asked a question. I said, well, who supports your desktop PCs for your local government today? And they said, well, we have a few people, you know, Bob and Joe and Susie who do that. And I said, okay, great. Who manages your payroll to pay your government officials? And they said, well, we have a couple of people who do that. And I said, well, why not outsource those functions to the private sector? Why not, you know, why are you competing with consulting and systems integrators who might provide that service? And they said, well, it's more cost-effective for us to have our own employees do that. And I said, well, that's really what we're talking about here, is that this technology and the use of unlicensed spectrum supports the ability for local governments to reevaluate their build versus buy, their insource versus outsource.
So in some sense, some of these carriers are consider it an entitlement to be able to to have the outsourcing of the telecommunications needs of the government, while arguing that the government ought not to be subsidizing private industry when, in fact, it's demanding that they provide business to them.
Well, it's really a silly notion, and I'll share my opinion on this topic, and that is, I think that if you look at cable and certainly telephone service, I won't say DSL, I'll say telephone service, primarily the PSTN or the traditional voice network, those systems result in essentially franchise fees that are paid to local government, and there's a view in some cases by incumbent providers of those kinds of services that they're somehow burdened by having to pay those franchise fees. The reality, and sort of a dirty little secret, I think, is that those franchise fees are actually collected from the end subscriber. So if any of us look on our phone bill, we'll see a $1 charge for local franchise tax. You'll see on your cable bill for television, you'll see the same thing. And I think that, in my opinion, is where some of this idea of entitlement comes from. The reality is there is no burden, in my view, for those companies because they're simply passing that burden, if you will, along to the end subscriber. but I do absolutely agree with you. I think there's this idea that there's some entitlement that somehow the government owes all of their telecommunications business to the private sector, and I think that that's largely not true anymore.
And in particular, the large incumbent private sector.
Mm-hmm. And even if you look at communities who've deployed, there are thousands of communities who've deployed their own fiber optic network.
Right.
This is really just another version of that, but it's not targeted on the backbone. It's targeted at the last mile.
Right.
So we could say that deploying wireless broadband for last mile connectivity by government for a network they own is a natural next step from where they've been, which is laying some of their own fiber.
We're going to talk about it a little later, but at Los Angeles, where I live and work, has a massive fiber optic plant, which is used for intra-governmental transmission of information. And WiMAX, as we're going to get to at the end of this discussion, I think would be a good addition to it in order to take it the last mile.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and actually there's an example project in Corpus Christi, Texas. It's a great project where wireless technology is being used to support automated meter reading for the public works. Another good example of how, rather than have 100 technicians who have to crawl around and check meters every month, in that case, they found a return on investment that was based on automating those meter readings. So they probably have an increased accuracy, not just decreases in the labor cost.
But then, of course, the unions may consider it an entitlement to go out
and
read the meters.
That's right.
So we're on.
That's right.
That's the kind of problem we've got. So have you been talking now about the business model? Is this cooperative wholesale one of the business models that you developed?
It is a business model, and we coined the term. We've actually seen the term now show up in a number of RFPs for other wireless municipal projects. I will tell you, though, that I think that Houston County, this is my opinion, is above the threshold for a community that will adopt the cooperative wholesale model. What I mean by that is there are 120,000 residents in the community, and it's actually anchored by Robins Air Force Base, defense contractors. It's a very high growth area, a lot of new people moving to the region.
Right.
I frankly think that the cooperative wholesale model has greater value if you go to a tiered city beneath, a tiered community, if you will, beneath Houston County. In a case where the private sector has, let's say, not done as good a job as they've done in Houston County, because frankly they have serviced 70% of the, 70 or more percent of the residents in the county and the businesses.
Right.
So I actually think cooperative wholesale, after going through the study and working with the community, I think my suspicion is that Houston County is going to end up being a private sector model. I think it's attractive enough for an organization to come together and fund, own, and operate, and in fact make quite a viable business out of acting as what I would call a wireless ISP.
Well, no. What you're saying here of the private sector model is different than the cooperative wholesale model.
That's correct. Private sector model is no taxpayer money. It's basically private industry steps up and makes the investment to deploy it and does it based on the fact that they believe there's a viable economic model there for them to make money.
So that could either be a huge telecom giant from out of state, or it could even be a cooperative of the people in the rural area.
That's absolutely correct.
Okay.
And I think that my prediction is that I think Houston County, based on the profile of the community and what we learned, I think it's more likely that it will go the private sector route. And I think that the cooperative wholesale ends up being something that works very, very well in an area that, let's say I have a county that's 400 square miles and only 50,000 residents.
Right. You're essentially saying a more rural, more sparsely populated place where incumbents haven't really taken care of most of the people already.
That's correct.
Okay. Let's talk specifically about what you did on the technology side and about Alvarion's participation. How did you why did you bring them in instead of somebody else?
Well, Siemens has a very close relationship. The company I was with at the time, Siemens, has a very close relationship with Alvarion. And Alvarion is also the world's leader in wireless broadband equipment. Now, that's a relatively speaking, a small market today, but it's a very, very high growth market, as you know, based on the momentum with WiMAX.
Right, and based on these interviews that are going to bring this to a wider audience itself. So.
Correct, correct. So we chose Alvarion. We also reached out to their U.S. president, Matt Stone, and I attended a conference in San Francisco. This was back in the April time frame, and had a chance to meet with their U.S. president, a gentleman named Amir Rosenzweig, and he frankly really impressed us with his knowledge of the business, of their solutions, and also his willingness to invest in the pilot that we were involved in.
say a little bit, or as much as you want, about how broadband wireless actually works. I've been thinking about it for the last few days to try to see if I could understand it, and maybe you could explain it. I could ask you one or two questions about that. How exactly is it that bits are transmitted from a tower to a place 12 miles away and received and processed and sent back? I mean, we're clear on how they're processed. They go in the computer and they're processed. How do they travel through the thin air at there and back?
Well, basically, you have two components to a wireless, two main components to a wireless broadband system. You have a base station, which consists of an antenna, typically mounted anywhere from 150 to 400 feet up on what you might call a cell tower or a communications tower.
How high does it need to be?
Well, it really depends. That's one of those issues that it depends on the distance and the cell size you're trying to reach. It depends on the frequency you're using,
right,
which might dictate the power output of the antenna.
Right.
It depends on the terrain, the foliage. But in terms of height, the height we used in the study was about 240 feet.
Okay.
So we had a single communications tower that we used to do the deployment testing.
Was Huston County very, what was its topography? Was it all flat?
I wouldn't call it all flat. I would say that it was semi-hilly.
Right.
If that's an accurate phrase.
If you've got such, yeah.
There's a lot of trees, and there's also a lot of pine trees, which are particularly difficult in dealing with RF propagation or radio frequency propagation.
Those pine needles absorb the radiation, huh?
They do. There's a lot of water content in pine needles, and water, of course, is the basis of how a microwave works in your kitchen. Is that
right?
The water in the food is heated up, so
you end up with hot trees, but no information.
Well, I hope they don't get hot, but not at the power output we were using. But
okay.
Yeah, you end up with a lot of signal loss.
This is a prefiguring of what we're going to talk about in a minute in Los Angeles. But if you've got really good sized mountains overlooking valleys, is that a useful configuration of the land for WiMAX?
Well, it can be. The approach that we took with Huston County, in addition to conducting, or I should say, after we conducted the feasibility testing, based on the results of that testing, we projected a theoretical design. There would be some additional work to do on this before it was deployed, but the design included the use of not just a single base station communicating with each of the locations that would be subscribing to the service,
right,
but it also included the use of what are called cell extenders. So in the example, Mark, that you gave, where I have, let's say I have a drop-off from where the tower is, and I don't have line-of-sight radio signal from the tower, and I have a drop-off, and on the other side is a cavern or a valley, if you will. What happens is the RF signal goes over the intended targets, and the way you can mitigate that is to use a cell extender that does have line of sight, or what's called near line of sight, back to the communications tower, and that cell extender redistributes the signal into the area that wouldn't have been reachable directly from the base station.
So sort of like one of those little airports that Apple builds. And sends down. Unfortunately and fortunately, I'm going to have to talk to Matt Stone in 5 minutes.
Okay.
To do another interview.
Well, that's great. But
there's some other things I'd like to talk to you about, more about the technology and how it works, what the results of the testing were, and in particular, I'm interested in knowing whether the results you found there could be sized up to cover something like the San Fernando Valley's million people. That's overlooked by some nice mountains that give straight lines to almost every place, and we have a lot fewer pine trees around here.
Good. Well, Mark, I appreciate your interest in the project. I'd be more than happy to speak with you and your audience at a later date.
Okay, good. So let me thank you for all this information now, and I'll get back to you, I hope, later this week, and we can continue our discussion about the broadband wireless access and also, of course, about your new company, Civitium, and what you're up to there.
Great. Thanks very much, Mark.
Thank you very much. Talk to you later.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.